A couple of weeks ago, two people were hiking in a rural state park in British Columbia when they slipped and tumbled down a steep rock face. They landed in a deep pool of water by a waterfall. They were beyond anyone's reach, and they couldn't pull themselves out. Several people witnessed this and immediately tried to call for help on their cell phones, but they had no reception that far out in the woods. Then a group of five young men happened along up the trail. They belonged to the Sikh faith. When they heard what had happened, they ran up to look down from atop the waterfall. They saw the hikers below. By this point, they were struggling to stay afloat. They were losing strength. As part of their Sikhism, the young men were wearing turbans. This is a central article of faith for Sikhs, a sign of religious devotion, love of God. It is never taken off in public. This must have been very much on their minds and hearts. Nevertheless, they didn't deliberate long. They undid their turbans from around their hair. They tied the five together, making a rope. They lowered this down till the hikers could grab hold of it, and they pulled the pair to safety. Later, they were asked, "Was it hard to do what you did? Did you feel like you compromised your religion by removing the turban?" And one of the young men replied, he said, "In Sikhism, we are taught to help someone in any way we can, with anything we have, even our turban. Love of God and love of neighbor, they're always tied together." That's the lesson of this gospel today. These young men, all under 30 years old, they understood that perfectly. They were living the greatest commandment. When a scribe asks Jesus which commandment is the greatest, Jesus replies by bringing together two parts of the Torah spaced far apart. Deuteronomy 6, which we heard in the first reading, love God with your whole heart, soul, and strength. And Leviticus 19, love your neighbor as yourself. So for him, these don't belong far apart at all. How we treat others is how we treat God. We can't love God without loving our neighbor. In the church of my college years, we used to end every liturgy by saying, "Our worship service has ended, and now our service truly begins." It was a good reminder that we show love of God not just through prayer, but everything that happens between times of prayer, everything we do to love our neighbor. We often talk about love as if it's ethereal, as if it's warm and fuzzy. The kind of love Jesus is speaking about, biblical love, is earthy. It shows itself through concrete actions. In fact, love your neighbor in Leviticus 19 comes as the summary of a longer list of commandments, many of them having to do with social and economic justice. So those include, do not exhaust the earth. Do not oppress the foreigner. Don't let the poor go hungry. Do not obstruct justice. Do not exploit workers. Do not discriminate against people with disabilities. Cornel West says, justice is what love looks like in public. So national spending plans, wage strikes, police accountability, climate summits like the one happening this week, these aren't just political issues, as we know. They're deeply spiritual issues. They're related to this commandment. In the biblical understanding, one of the major ways we love our neighbor is by working for a just world. There's a mystical side to what Jesus says here also. Love of God, love of neighbor, love of ourselves, somehow they're all one for him. Because we are one with God and our neighbor. We imagine that we're separate, but we're not. A couple of weeks ago, Reverend Myra and I attended a community meeting over at Spiritus led by Sister Grace Miller, focused on addressing homelessness in Rochester. And the group got talking about Peace Village, which is the encampment downtown, the outdoor encampment. When it was first constructed, the city put up a huge fence separating it off from the rest of the area and hiding it from view. And Reverend Myra wondered aloud what that fence cost and what might have happened if the thousands of dollars that went into building a fence had been put instead to creating housing for people who needed it, or lowering some of the other barriers that people face that keep them from getting housed. We spend a lot of money, of time, of energy putting up divides between each other. We invest a lot in this illusion that we're separate, but we aren't. When Kabul fell to the Taliban in August, a high school teacher from here in upstate New York named Megan Brown contacted one of her former students who had immigrated from Afghanistan. She knew some of his relatives were still there, and she texted him to ask if they were okay. She said, "I didn't think there was anything I could really do to help from so far away, but it was just to show him that I cared." The reply came back from her student that the situation was getting worse and that his relatives were trying to find an escape. Megan was sharing this with some of her colleagues at school, and one of them mentioned a teacher at another local school, a man named Zach Lois, who was also a retired Army captain, and he was part of a unit of retired Special Forces officers who called themselves the Pineapple Express. The Pineapple Express was inspired by Harriet Tubman, and they were functioning as an underground railroad, helping Afghans sneak past Taliban checkpoints and escape through the airport. So they would shepherd families using a secret code sent to their phones that functioned as a password, a pineapple on a pink background. Megan sent Zach a message. He immediately offered to help the family of her student. He said he'd try to get them out that night. He sent a map. He sent them a location of a meeting place and a time that they had to be there to be picked up. It took several tries. They were turned back once or twice because it was just too dangerous or somehow their way was blocked. The family was getting discouraged, but because Megan stayed on the phone with them, they persevered. She was texting right along the way, sending them messages from Zach and telling them just don't give up. She stayed with them throughout the night. Just before sunrise, they started to hear a rumor that the airport would be shut down. And Zach thought of a desperate move, that maybe if they could get a message to the family, that they should jump into this canal that ran alongside the field by the airport, maybe they could make their way down that to the airport gate. Well, they took a look at it. The water was chest high and dirty. This was not a trek they wanted to make. But Megan, again, it was her voice that urged them on. She said, "Get into the water, move to the Americans, show the pineapple on the screen of your phone, and they will pick you up." And she sent them a satellite image of where they should go. 11 minutes went by, no response, and then at last, a text message, "We are in," followed by 8 smiling heart emojis. All 15 family members were evacuated through the airport the next day. Soon after that, Megan got a call from her student's father, the patriarch of the family. They had never spoken before. His first words to her were, "You are my family now. You're my sister." He added, "I don't know if you have a brother, but now I am your brother." And at that, Megan's eyes filled with tears, good tears, because her brother, Chris, was a Navy pilot. He'd flown missions over Kabul. He'd been killed in 2018 in New Mexico, flying an experimental new aircraft that he was test driving. He'd volunteered for that mission very purposefully. Its aim was to develop a plane that would help reduce civilian casualties in Afghanistan. That's what he died trying to do. And Megan knew that if he were alive, he would be right where she was, working with the Pineapple Express to help get people out. Now she found herself looking into the eyes of this Afghan man standing before her, and his words just kept echoing in her ears. "I am your brother. I am your brother." We are not strangers, but family. That's who we really are. We aren't separate. We're one. Sometimes the neighbor that we're called to love is a stranger on the other side of the world. Other times it's someone much closer at hand. Sometimes it's someone in our immediate family. The other half of that famous quote from Cornel West is, "Tenderness is what love feels like in private. So justice is what love looks like in public. Tenderness is what love feels like in private. And maybe there's someone in your family or your closest circle who just needs a little extra tenderness right now. I heard a tender story on the radio over this Halloween weekend. Several people were being interviewed about Halloweens that they'll never forget. Two siblings, Fritzy and Bobby Huber, were reminiscing together. They're grown now, but they spent their whole childhood traveling the country in a 26-foot trailer. Their parents were traveling performers, so that was home for them. And that being the case, they never got to have a real Halloween. They never were grounded in a neighborhood. They never had other houses where they could go door-to-door trick-or-treating. So they were baffled when this one Halloween, their parents announced, "You're going trick-or-treating this year." At that point, their trailer was parked in an empty field, not another house around for miles. How was this going to work? But their parents insisted, just put your costumes on and go outside and just circle the field once and come back around and knock on the door. And they pointed at their door, their own front door. So they headed out into the field, they circled once around, came back, knocked on the door, and when it opened, no surprise, there were their two parents standing there, dropping a couple pieces of candy into the pillowcases that they held out. And they thought, trick-or-treating over, there's nowhere else to go, what else is there to do? But their mother said, "Now go knock on the next door." And she gestured to the back door of the trailer. So they walked around the 26 feet to the back door. And after a long pause, it opened. There were their parents again, but this time they weren't quite themselves. They had gray hair, and they were dressed differently. They appeared to be an older couple. See, being traveling performers has its advantages. Their wardrobe was full of all kinds of costumes. So the older couple dropped a couple more treats into the pillowcases, and then they went around to the front door again. It opened. There were their parents, this time in towering top hats. They went back to the back door. There they were in circus regalia. Back and forth for an hour between the two doors of the trailer, and each time a different character greeted them. All sorts of people answered their knock. As time went on, their parents started dropping stuff from the kitchen cupboards into the pillowcases. They didn't have much money, so there wasn't an infinite supply of candy. There was only the food they already had. The cases filled up with cans of soup and boxes of cereal, bags of pasta and rice. But none of that mattered. It was the experience that counted. They got to go trick-or-treating for the first time in their life, and they were just thrilled. When the bags became too heavy to lift, they called it a night. They went back inside. Their parents became themselves again. And they pretended to be curious about what was in the pillowcases. They said, "So how did you do? Show us what you got." And they pulled the cans of soup and the cereal out, and they feigned extra surprise. They said, "How wonderful. I was just thinking of going to the store for that. As you can see, our cupboards are empty." So they all restocked the cupboard together. They put the food back that had just been handed out moments before. It wasn't candy, but it did feel pretty good to watch the shelves fill up again and appreciate what they had, that they had enough to eat. They never forgot that Halloween, that their parents became neighbors to them, became an entire neighborhood, in fact, out of tenderness, out of love. It was a holy night. Self, others, God, in love, they all begin to blur together. And maybe God's hope for us this week is just that we will do what the Hubers did, that we'll find new ways to become neighbors to each other. Then the barriers can come down, and each day will be a holy day.